What an absolutely fascinating world, or a scary world, depending on how you look at it, Sir Charles Schulz is presenting to us. And not 50 years from now, not 100 years from now, but very imaginably soon, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, a lot of the stuff described is right upon us. Now, your turn to ask questions is coming up, and I imagine you have many. Sir Charles, are you ready?
Absolutely. Let's shoot for it.
Okay. I do want to make sure you get to plug your website. Of course, we've got a link, but I mean, go ahead.
Okay. I also wanted to point out there's some other things on the site besides what we've been talking about.
Okay.
Xenotechresearch.com, XenoTechResearch.com. My book will be out within a couple of weeks or so. And also, I'd like to thank Dave Dunning, one of my lab assistants, for the work he did, Ed Munchau, the engineer who's doing my space research work with me, and Andy Doan, my webmaster, for the support on the wonderful website he's designed for me.
So, you've got kind of a team.
Oh, quite a few people do quite a number of contributions in the work, yes.
Okay, first time caller line, you're on the air with Sir Charles. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Oh, yeah, I got a question about the robo-rat. I've got a pet rat. He's right here, actually. And I'm wondering, you know, how invasive are most of these scanning and control things? Do you have to do surgery on the subjects or anything like that?
Yes, in fact, they do. They surgically implant the electrodes in the rat, and then from that point on, they can control the rat as they wish. But, of course, they have to have downtime, and they have to allow them to eat and do what any biological organism will.
And I just wanted to say that you were talking about someone being divorced because of an affair with a computer program. Well, I've seen quite a few friends of mine have nasty breakups and problems with their relationships due to playing too many video games and spending too much time in online RPGs. So we may have already made that point.
Yeah, you really do make a good point. It's already happening, isn't it, Sir Charles?
It certainly looks that way.
So the internet is beginning to become something that is getting between people right now, much less what you're just talking about tonight. I mean, my God. So we can see it happening right now, really. People breaking up because of chat sessions on the internet or whatever. So what a world. And what a world just upon us. Wildcard line, you're on the air with Sir Charles. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes. My name is Edward. I'm in Orange County.
Yes.
And it's a pleasure to speak to both of you, by the way.
Thank you.
I was in a conversation, this was a few years back, and this sounds a little like science fiction, but I wondered if Sir Charles knew anything about it. In the conversation, it was discussed that there was experimentation done with the disintegration and reintegration of a biological life form. And in fact, it was done successfully, but because it was, or when it was reintegrated, it literally did not have any functions.
You're talking about a transporter.
In a sense, yes.
Uh-huh.
And because it didn't have any functions, neurological functions or memories, experimentation was being done to fuse engrams or neurons to a computer chip, and literally before the disintegration process, in other words, from that life form to the computer chip. And all of the functions were then downloaded into that computer chip with those engrams or whatever they are on the computer chip.
Well, I certainly was not aware that we had a transporter for life forms. And what you're saying is we do, or somebody's done it, and then...
Well, this came up in a conversation, and I trust the person that was talking about it.
Okay, well, that it seems a little out of the realm of possibility, but let's ask, Sir Charles,
anything at this point that is used to disintegrate and reassemble organisms, but I can tell you this much, there were some experiments done with brain tissue and types of an antifreeze so that they could freeze in cryonic mode, freeze and then reactivate the brain tissue after thawing it. And one of the interesting things they discovered is when you thaw out neurons after they've been successfully frozen, if they have not been damaged, they automatically resume firing as if they have been all along. So they don't need to jumpstart them once they're activated again.
As in reanimation?
Yes, true. As it's applications in cryonics where you can freeze a person's body or head and then years later thaw them out and reactivate them. There has been a lot of research done on that, and it looks like nanotechnology will be the way they'll turn to prevent or repair cellular damage when that becomes practical.
Do you think that it's enough of a real possibility that you would have yourself frozen?
I think that it is believable enough that, yes, if given the opportunity, I think that would be a safe bet. Absolutely.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Sir Charles. Hi.
Hi, Art and Sir Charles from Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Russell here. Well, where to begin? I'd like to start, though, with the work of Mark DeMuha. That's D as in David, E-M-U-C-H-A, who was on George Norrie's show a little while back, who revealed on his work involving Tesla, the Tesla conspiracy, that a radiant energy tapping device was retrofitted in a Pierce Arrow car in 1931, ran the car for about 3 days at speeds of up to 90 miles an hour, and there was no battery. I would very much like to suggest that Sir Charles take a look at that, because I think that's an important area of concern, and the patent was put on the coasttocoastam.com site as a request brought in.
Okay, you have a question.
I'd like to ask Sir Charles if, in fact, we have the ability to apply nano-solar technology to this energy situation. Where's the state of the art on that, and what is the cost justification that's being bandied about with regards to the expense for this?
Right, you are. We're hearing about paints, for example, that will generate electricity, just paint your house and all the rest of that thing up in Canada. And so where are we?
Well, right now, it looks like the same material they were building for the space elevator also has the ability to be used optically and possibly to convert light into electricity directly. Various lengths of nanofiber can be used, tuned to visible and infrared light, to convert it directly to electrical power. Mm-hmm. As to how far they've gone within the last few months, I don't know, but I do know the breaking point will be when they can manufacture it and it produces power for about half the cost of what you buy off the line, then they'll begin selling stuff like that.
Yes, nanotechnology really does carry this potential promise, or is it a sure thing?
I think it's a sure thing because we're learning more every day about it, and the way it's grown just within the last 5 years would just astound people if they knew.
I have a kind of a sense of it, and I can see it's going very, very quickly. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Sir Charles. Hi.
Hi, good evening, Art. Boy, these shows, this one has got me on the edge of the seat.
Me too.
Good evening, Sir Charles. It's a pleasure to talk with you. I've called to ask a burning question that I've had for a long time, and that is, when will the time come when this kind of technology will be used in operating systems of computers so we don't have to go crazy upgrading and it can learn on its own?
Yeah, that's a good question. All right.
Well, I know that some people that I've talked with are working on adaptive operating systems that can take care of their own damage and repair it very easily and can also adapt to the environment that they are in. The only problem with that sort of technology is maintaining compatibility. If your operating system is smart enough to grow itself or repair itself, it may change itself so severely that you can't operate off-the-shelf software anymore. So that's one of the concerns.
That wouldn't be all that different than what we have now.
That's true.
All right. Let's see. International Line, you're on the air with Sir Charles. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi, Art and Sir Charles. I was just wondering if the psychiatric world is at all ready for people coming in and saying that there's cockroaches following them around. You know?
Well, we already know that there are small vehicles and devices that can be operated remotely. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't surprise me too much if people have already said such things, but you know, the technology is there, and it's going to be available very shortly on the street, and you can bet that you'll also see it in applications for search and rescue, for instance, or, you know, running wires through a building. It's difficult to do because it's difficult to access those places.
Yeah,
you're going to see
yeah.
it very soon everywhere.
Yeah, what if it was like mosquitoes even, you know, if they could get that small?
And actually, believe it or not, it isn't that difficult because if we can use nanotechnology to create light sensors and electronic devices as small as the head of a mosquito, then we could put a television camera on a mosquito.
Yeah, and then where would privacy be, eh?
Well, that's a very good question right now regarding the Internet and all of the information we place out in the world every time you use a credit card.
Yeah,
there you go. All right.
Kind of scary.
First-time caller line, your turn with Sir Charles.
Hey, this is Buddy from Mississippi.
Yes, sir.
First-time caller. I'm very interested in what y'all are talking about. I'm a light worker. I've woke up to a greater consciousness of the universe that says that we're all one mind, that mind that thinks as the union of our minds being collectively known as the awakening.
Mm.
What you speak of as far as the technology, all that comes from the source of all being, which is God. And that is happening right now as we speak.
All right, let's ask Sir Charles about that. That's a tough question.
There may be a very good answer for that.
Yes.
Because of the way that we're progressing, we expect that pretty soon we may see direct mind-to-machine interface. And you have to ask yourself the question, what happens when 100 or 1,000 or 1 billion people link their minds together in a network? Is it something that will allow them to think together as one, or is it something that will give everyone an induced epileptic seizure? It's difficult to say. I think that we can only wait and hold our breath and see what happens.
Okay. Wild card line, you're on the air with Sir Charles. Hi.
Hello, this is Jason in Oregon.
Yes, sir.
How are you guys doing this evening?
Fine.
Very well.
Okay, Sir Charles, I had a question for you. I was wondering if you were aware... and if you knew the state of the technology at this point, it was a computer-human interface. It had little pads that hooked up to the skull, and it monitored the person's response to images that were being shown. And if the person recognized the image, the computer would pick up the brainwave, and
right.
it could tell if you had seen that before. And it was basically a lie detector type machine.
Yes, that's
and I was
exactly
wondering if you knew
the
anything
sort of
about
technology
that.
That we were talking about.
Well, listen off the air. Thanks, guys.
All right. Again, applications for truth-telling or lie-detecting.
Well, there's a fellow by the name of Daniel Langelben at the University of Pennsylvania that's found that he can use functional MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, to detect the presence of truth or lie in your thoughts.
And when do you see the application of this kind of technology for the kind of purpose we talked about a little while ago, airports, whatever?
When you can make an MRI machine portable, you're going to see it there.
Well, we're constantly making things smaller and smaller. Of course, it requires a very large electromagnetic pulsing field, right?
Well, if you could come up with smaller supermagnets or possibly room temperature superconductors, you'll see them in a suitcase.
Mm-hmm, a suitcase. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Sir Charles. Good morning.
Hello.
Hello.
This is Calvin from Georgia.
Yes.
I have a question. Is there any of this stuff being developed in space in zero gravity or in the near future? And I'll listen on the side. Thank
you. All right. You're very welcome.
I do expect that pretty soon we're going to see some nano hardware in orbit, particularly in regard to the space elevator. But any of the materials that we make that require, very clean, not undisturbed environments could benefit greatly from being manufactured in space. I know a lot of people hear about protein crystals and bone replacement ceramics that are fluffy like a loaf of bread. They're very low mass and they have low density. Those sorts of materials are going to be made in space very commonly in the very near future due to private industry advancing the way it is.
Why is it so much easier in zero gravity?
Well, for one thing, on the ground, certain materials won't mix because they're heavier than other materials and they'll separate out. For instance, lead and aluminum. it's difficult to make an alloy of lead and aluminum because the lead sinks to the bottom.
Right.
In microgravity, you can mix them successfully, and they'll stay mixed pretty well. The other thing is called convection. When you have a material that is hot, convection tends to make it swirl a certain way. The hottest material rises under the influence of gravity, and the cooler material sinks.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in microgravity, you can eliminate a great deal of convection cooling so that your crystals can be purer and cleaner and better aligned.
All right. West of the Rockies, your turn with Sir Charles.
West of the Rockies?
Yep.
That's me. John from Oregon. My question is, when do you think there will be indisputable evidence that, to the more scientifically naive, that there's no free will?
Well, I can't even say that there is evidence of no free will, and I'll tell you why. Quantum mechanics guarantees that you can never exactly predict the outcome of a system. Even if time travel were allowed, I suspect that your ability to make a decision, whether you act on it or not, is the hallmark of free will.
International Line, you're on the air with Sir Charles. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Quite well, sir.
It's a pleasure to speak with you, Art.
Thank you.
Sir Charles, my question, I'm Rod calling from Canada. My father has Alzheimer's at the age of 60. What application does nanotechnology have or will have with regeneration of cells for Alzheimer's or Parkinson's patients?
In the short term, it appears that they can culture neurons and inject them in the brain, and they have the ability to replace damaged neurons. They're studying the ability of neural tissue to target the area it's supposed to be in. Technically, they've made a great deal of advances in it, and they hope to have a sort of a vaccine that can inject neurons into your brain and replace damaged cells or tissues in the near future, like within a couple of years. I don't know where the clinical trials stand right now, but they may be able to take a sample of your own tissue, grow neurons, and then inject them into your own brain and do the repairs that way.
You are just amazingly optimistic. Most people like yourself, Sir Charles, that I interview, talk much farther down the line for the sort of exotic things that we're talking about right now. I mean, artificially going in and repairing Alzheimer's damage, that kind of thing. You're talking about 2 years. You're very optimistic.
Well, I am, because I see a number of people and the things that they're doing in the field, and understand that much of what gets done these days is accelerating because they have a better access to information, and there is a great deal of funding for this sort of research because people are concerned about their well-being.
Indeed.
And believe it or not, a lot of it comes from insurance agencies, because if they can lower their premiums by keeping people healthier, then they're happy.
Well, that's true. But on the other hand, it's going to be very expensive, and the insurance companies are going to have to pay for it.
Well, mass production drives the cost of everything down.
Yes. Lower prices every day. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Sir Charles.
Hello, Art. Hello, Sir Charles. How are you both tonight?
Fine, thank you.
Question for Sir Charles. With regard to the organics and personality of such systems, for instance, going back to the nematode, you were saying that this 900-cell creature was replicated on a computer format. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Would it behave organically as a nematode within the computer medium?
Hmm.
Yes, it did. As far as I know, they were successful in simulating all the neural signals that it fired. In order to make a complete success of it, you'd have to simulate its body in software as well, and then
right.
create a synthetic world for it to act in. Now, this is a very interesting part of artificial intelligence research. You don't want to build a robot that could turn on you and smash everything in the lab. And so what you do instead is you create an artificial environment in a computer.
Once again, Sir Charles Schultz III, welcome back. And it's kind of fun just to go through a whole bunch of calls, and you seem to have the answers right there. You're doing very well. First-time caller line, your turn. Hi.
Yes, Sir Charles, I had a question concerning safety protocols with the new VR AI world that we're on the verge of. In a sci-fi book printed by Tad Williams, the main plot line is that through the virtual interface that our bodies will be exchanged with, to be uploaded and to interact with the new VR world, there is a possibility of, how shall I say, neural kidnapping, to where those code lines of our imprinting from ourselves could be kidnapped in VR to where our bodies would remain comatose. And I was wondering if you had any input on that. Tad Williams' book is called Otherland. It's a very well-brought series, and it'd be readily available to where you might be able to get some information from it. And
okay, well, let's tackle virtual kidnapping. That's kind of interesting, Sir Charles.
Well, there would have to be a mechanism for it. When you play a video game, your mind doesn't go anywhere, and if you put on a virtual reality headset, your mind doesn't go anywhere. The sensations are there. If you were to be able to directly plug your brain into a computer, let's say, so it generated a convincing image of the world around you, it wouldn't make your mind go anywhere. Your brain would still be in your head processing the information. Now, there's a possibility with that sort of an interface, they might be able to make a copy of your mind, which is the uploading question all over again. But it certainly wouldn't change the way your brain operated or your body operated unless there was some physical change made.
But it would, it might be possible without a person's consent to virtually kidnap them.
To copy their mind, certainly. And then if the system were complex enough, then they could interrogate the copy.
And we worry about identity theft today.
Huh. It would be a true identity theft.
Yeah. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Sir Charles. Hi.
Hi, Art.
Yes.
Can't believe I actually got in.
It looks like you have.
I imagine so. Anyhow, a few years ago, there was a movie out, Brainstorm, and earlier in the show, I was just thinking, why wasn't somebody mentioning it? And I was wondering how long before we'll get that that kind of total body experience.
Well, we've been talking all around it, sir. Really, without saying Brainstorm, that's exactly what we're talking about, isn't it, Sir Charles?
Yes, it is. The only thing they had in the movie that we don't have here and now is that interface that plugs into your head
right, inobtrusively
without actually being wired into your brain and allows you to send and receive the sensory impressions and the data. That's the only thing we don't have.
And I wonder how far away that is.
Could be around the corner.
Yeah, yeah. I have this feeling. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Sir Charles. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Dean Rose here. Pleasure to be on your show, sir.
Thank you.
I had a question for Dr. Schultz, whether or not we can hook up an electroencephalogram to the actual artificial intelligence in order to make sure it stays in the alpha rhythm and doesn't implode into the beta rhythm and decides to take over the world.
Well, you know, the reason an electroencephalogram works is because it's detecting the sum total of the electrical activity in your brain, and it's being picked up at the skin level, for instance. But there is no actual neuron involved if you have a copy of a mind or an artificial intelligence. It's all a simulation. So there really wouldn't be a place to hook it up. Would the electrical rhythms exist? Perhaps so. It depends on how faithfully the copy is made. It may be that they don't copy neurons at all, simply the operating rules, in which case an electroencephalogram wouldn't work anyway.
All right. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Sir Charles. Hi.
Hi, Sir Charles. Art, this is a great honor to be speaking with you.
Thank you. This is Gypsy.
I'm a truck driver. I drive between Utah and Idaho every night,
gotcha. And
I enjoy your program.
Thank you. My question
tonight is, how secure, Sir Charles, is my job? If we're coming on to the technology where the vehicles will drive themselves, how long is it before we see 18-wheelers driving themselves? And I'll take my answer off the air, and I thank you very much.
In other words, I heard that. She's wondering when she's going to get a pink slip.
It is a very good question, and I know many people are concerned about truck drivers who spend many hours on the road and have a very tough time staying awake.
You bet.
I suspect what we're going to see is a supervisory system in 3 to 5 years, and after that, depending on how well they perform and how well they're accepted legally, it may very well be that trucks will automatically drive their routes and just have a human standing by just in case.
riding along.
That's right, shotgun.
Wow. Well, already they track trucks. A lot of trucks have GPS info that's constantly transmitted back to the home office, and so you're saying the next...
The basis of the system is there.
Hi, you're on the air with Sir Charles.
Is that me?
That's you.
All right. It's a pleasure to be on the show. Thank you for this amazing discussion. Firstly, I was just wondering what technology would be there to connect the mind with the machine? And secondly, what universities are doing the most work with this?
All right. What kind of interface hardware exists now, if any?
Some of the interface hardware is pretty crude. It's measuring voltages and magnetic fields. As far as being able to inject signals back in, right now, direct wiring is the only way to do it. I suspect what will happen is they'll work out some sort of an implant or chip that can be injected into your head that will wire itself into your sensory system. And it may very well be that that isn't practical right now, but we'll begin to see that in the near future. I know there are already chips that can be implanted in the brain and act as a go-between.
Well, I interviewed a scientist, Sir Charles, who was having something implanted into his arm, and he rather thought that the neuron path from some place in his arm, I can't recall, to his brain would work. What do you think?
Well, there's no reason to think that it wouldn't, but you wouldn't want to use a direct electrical connection. You'd probably use a capacitive connection, and then there'd be nothing to prevent you from sending or receiving information to and from neurons. I know we can play back the signals and record them right now.
Oh, yes. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Sir Charles. Good morning. Hello?
Good morning.
Yes, sir.
Vince calling from Buffalo, New York. You were talking earlier about the Robo-Rat, and I just had an interesting thought. Instead of, you know, implanting a camera, how long would it be before they, say, tapped into the creature's optic nerve?
Uh-huh.
And in that case, selecting species that would work well in, say, low-light situations.
Actually, you know, that's a little more difficult than it appears. The reason is what happens in the back of the eye isn't simply photocells like we have in, let's say, a television chip. The reason is there's wiring, like three layers of neural wiring in your retina that figures out from the primitive signals what the higher, more symbolic symbols are that go to your brain. So when you're tapping into the optic nerve, you're getting pre-digested information that has a lot going on in it. It's more like corners, vertices, and illumination. That's a little tougher than it sounds. For a present, it'd be much easier to just put a television camera chip in there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Sir Charles. Hi.
Good evening, Art.
Good evening.
This is Chris calling from San Pedro, California, listening to KFI Radio.
Yes, sir.
Lying next to me is my best friend, a 22-year-old Persian cat who's hooked up to IV fluids, and she's falling to renal failure due to polycystic kidney disease, a genetic disorder.
Sorry.
I'm wondering if this technology could help anybody with this disease.
Well, there's a million medical applications for this, right?
Yes, there are. We will expect to see in the near term new medications and then pretty soon new physical therapies. When nanomachinery and our ability to control how it works and what it produces becomes far more refined, we may be able to repair or replace destroyed or damaged cell tissues and go from there with synthetic materials or truly biological materials. It all depends on our control of how the machines operate and how complex we can make them on a small scale.
Yes, but nanotechnology almost holds the promise of becoming the new medicine altogether, doesn't it?
Well, I would expect that would be exactly where it would go.
Yeah. Oh. Wildcard line, you're on the air with Sir Charles. Hi.
Hi, Art. Hi, Sir Charles. How are you guys doing?
Great.
It's a pleasure to talk to you. I currently work with a large database company, and I provide internal help desk, and, you know, according to the type of calls that we get there, I can only imagine what we would get when people have problems with their dream interfaces.
Yes, for Dorothy 3.4, anyway, I can see you at the help desk with that one.
It would kind of continue that legacy of the guy calling in to clear his internet cache. Except you got to pop into that dream with a blindfold.
Yes. Anyway, do you have a question?
No, I was just wondering what kind of problems and things like that he could see coming up like that. like if somebody runs into a dead end in one of these neurological transmitter devices, you know, I don't know, where's the call the help button, you know?
Yeah, you know, it's sort of like having to call the phone company for service when your phone doesn't work. You're kind of at a catch-22. I do imagine that there will have to be some sort of a support early on, some sort of system that will allow you to have a fallback. I don't know what that would be right now. The complexity of the system is daunting at this point, and it's going to take years before we really work out all the implications and where it's going to go.
All right.
But certainly there will be a whole technology developed just to handle those exceptions.
East of the Rockies, and he'll be at the desk. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Sir Charles. Hi.
Thank you. It's an honor. I was just wondering if there's been any thought or any type of progress or put into the idea of, say, someone's physical body being damaged and trying to, can the brain live by itself to where it could be put into a man-made machine and then sort of let the brain interact with the machine itself instead of a scan?
Well, that's what we've been talking about, Sir Charles.
Well, the real problem with keeping brain tissue alive externally like that is pretty simple. When you're at the level of a few cells in a petri dish, it's not so hard because you're supplying the sensory data to it through electrodes and you're getting information out through electrodes. And it just basically takes glucose and oxygen to keep the thing alive. When you're talking about a whole brain, your body is a very complex factory with, you know, hundreds of different chemicals that are moving through it all the time, carrying messages and performing tasks. When you move a brain into a machine, you have to replicate all of the functions of the body that are necessary to keep that brain alive.
Mm-hmm.
At right now, I would say that's going to be a little ways off. We are probably going to make far more progress in mind uploading than in keeping your brain alive for an extended period of time.
Yeah, but you're still talking about an avalanche of ethical, moral dilemma.
Absolutely. I can see that people will really want to argue whether that's the individual still alive and whether they have the right to execute property agreements or earn money or write a will.
So the lawyer,
I would say as long as your brain is alive and able to communicate, then you would be.
Sounds like a victory for the lawyers to me.
They'll make the money on it.
Yeah, that's right. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Sir Charles. Hi.
Hi, Art.
Hello.
This is Margaret from Los Angeles.
Yes.
And hi to Sir Charles.
Hello.
What a fantastic program on technology. I do have a medical question for Sir Charles. What I want to ask him is that if this is where we're heading, then I'm sure people would come off wheelchairs and spinal and heart problems would become something of the past.
Yes, ma'am. All of that, as we mentioned a few moments ago, it would be the new medicine. In other words, it would virtually treat, ultimately capable of being of treating everything.
We could regrow a lost organ or a limb on command if we had that understanding.
Exactly. So it would be the new medicine. Medicine as we know it would probably end, wouldn't it, Sir Charles?
Absolutely. There would be a whole new way of dealing with illness or your health. You probably would be injected with a series of nanomachines like miniature robots, smaller than blood cells, that would patrol your body and watch out for damage and regulate toxins or problems that you have. It would take care of it right on the spot and would be able to help you overcome whatever illnesses or damages you had. But not only that, the ability to edit or change yourself also becomes possible.
We, of course, have been talking all night, Sir Charles, and I'm glad, about the optimistic side of all of this. The problem is nanotechnology presents opportunities in warfare that, frankly, make atomic weapons look like toys.
That's true, and it's often referred to as the Grey Goose Syndrome.
Well, that or targeting specific nationalities or racial tendencies or...
Or programming everybody to become a copy of yourself.
That's right.
Hijacking them entirely.
Exactly.
Yeah, so, all is possible.
Yeah, not only possible, but probably will get better funding, you know, on the dark side of things. We really should do one night a program on, chilling as it would be, all the possibilities on the black side of this.
would you like to do a whole show on nanotechnology?
Yes, I would.
I think that'd be a wonderful plan, and I'd still like to cover more on the AI and the virtual world at some point.
So, all right, let's do it. One more in. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Sir Charles. Hello.
Good morning, Art.
Good morning, sir.
This is Kevin, Tuttleham operator also.
Okay, Kevin, not a lot of time, so...
Well, what I was wondering is, with the nanotechnology, would there be a possibility of them, government using it as a way to spy on you as far as anything like that?
Of course.
Absolutely.
Absolutely, yes.
Spies the size of a single cell.
Or spies that are able to, I don't know, look at, read your thoughts. Virtually read your thoughts.
It's not outside possibility.
Or get a copy of your thoughts, or a snapshot of your thoughts, responding to a particular stimuli, as you mentioned earlier. Show the person a picture of a bomb, and they would have no choice. They would think about what they're doing, and you would have them. Right?
That's correct.
Wildcard line, you're on the air with Sir Charles.
Hi there.
Hi there.
My name is Ronnie. I'm calling from Pennsylvania.
Okay.
I'm a Vietnam veteran.
Very quickly, we're almost out of time.
Okay. I want to know, right now, is there a possibility for diabetes to be cured?
Okay. All right. Well,
they're working on it right now. They're working on methods of controlling insulin's production and use in the body with synthetic organs that act as the pancreas does. The Isles of Langerhans produce the insulin. They're working on that right now.
So that one is not so distant. That one could be one of the first. Is that correct?
Very well.
So, but again, to put off other questions like this, ultimately, this technology would be the new medicine. It would treat virtually everything. So they don't have to ask about individual, would it do this or do that? It would do it all.
In the end, that's correct.
What gets me about the whole show we've done tonight is how close all of this is right now, Sir Charles.
Oh, almost everything within 5 years, yes.
God, that's incredible. All right, my friend, what can I say? Thank you for being here, and what a ride, buddy.
It has been a pleasure, Art.
Take care.
You too.